You were listening to some Dhamma today from Robert Thurman. And predictably enough, what I picked up from his talk was not his exposition of the Vimalakirti Sutra or anything like that, but his references to the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, and the Dhamma that he learnt, I, Me, Mine, from the Beatles. There are lots of good Dhamma found from the Beatles. And of course that he learnt one of the great lessons, Dhamma lessons, which we all learnt from one of our first Dhamma teachers, Mick Jagger. He taught us, I can't get no satisfaction. Which is a lesson that we're still trying to work on. So I had many great Dhamma teachers as songwriters, Bob Dylan and so on. Always one of my favourite Dhamma songwriters was Tom Waits, who taught me never drive a car when you're dead. It's one of the memorable lines of his songs. So I've always followed that rule assiduously. And another thing that he said that I always really struck me and remembered was that he said in an interview one time that the problem is that music is round and instruments are square. And I knew, as soon as he said that, I knew exactly what he meant, being a musician. And he himself in his career had gone from playing the piano mostly, and then around that time he did that interview, it was in the early 80s, and then he started to play things like the accordion. When you play the accordion, you kind of wrap yourself in this kind of twisted instrument which you pull around yourself, rather than kind of sitting at something. You pull it around yourself. It's a very different kind of relationship with an instrument. And so this is always the problem also with the Dhamma is exactly the same thing, is that the texts are square but the Dhamma is round. And is Dhamma something that we sit at and play? So that we have to adapt ourselves to it. So it sort of sits there like a big square lump of stuff, like a piano, that we have to sort of approach and sit down in a formal relationship with. Or is Dhamma something like an accordion, where you strap it onto yourself and you pull it around and twist it so that it wraps all around you? So this is the problem, this is our task, is to find some way to wrap ourselves around in the Dhamma. Perhaps this is what the Buddha was thinking of when he used the symbol of a wheel to represent the Dhamma. It's something round. And because it's round, it goes all around us. So there's this waking cry of hope, which calls out to us from deep in the heart. It's like the sound of a bird on a still dark night. This recognition of the truth that we are immersed in, that we're swimming in. Utirnum hi jati ajara maranena sukehi parideve dukehi domana sehi upaya sehi dukho tirno dukha pareto. I'm overwhelmed with, I'm swamped by birth, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair. I'm swamped by suffering, immersed in suffering. Abhivanami imasake vilasa dukkake dukkha kandasa antitirya panyayetha. Could there be an ending of this entire mass of suffering? Could this be the case? Could this be real? Perhaps there might be this ending. If only there were this ending. It's like this small voice inside of us which is calling out with a sense of longing. A sense of, like an intuition, something we don't know, but we feel, we have faith in, we intuit. And where does that feeling arise from? Where is that intuition actually born in? Somewhere in this mysterious and elusive world of the mind. Well, which is so hard to catch hold of, so hard to get a handle of. As soon as we look, runs away, pretends we can't see it, like one of the echidnas that you meet sometimes on the path around here. And walking along the path and there it is, this echidna, by the side of the path. It's just there, they're very slow, they can't run away. And he doesn't try to run away or even try to hide, he just kind of curls up a little bit and pretends not to be there. And you can see in the little echidna mind, he's going, I'm not here, you can't see me. He's so cute. It makes you want to bend down and pat them. Of course, you know, that probably isn't a wise thing to do. It's interesting where you, in Australia, we're so used to the idea of echidna being a small spiny anteater that I was quite surprised when I found out the actual original meaning of the word echidna was one of the primordial monsters in Greek mythology, like the Sphinx and many others, the Leviathan in Judaic mythology or what have you. And it's kind of a formless and bizarre and sort of creature, like the thing from the Black Swamp. I guess the first settlers thought that the echidna was such a bizarre animal that they had to name it after something like that. And so we have these echidnas in the mind as well, don't we? You know, it's so, it's quite, we forget, we lose sight of how strange it is, how shocking it is that we understand our mind so little. We may have all these schools of meditation and philosophy and Abhidhamma and everything for thousands of years, and these days all of these university departments studying psychology and doing all these experiments and things like that. And it's very rare to find someone who really captures the essence of it. There's a very beautiful paragraph near the beginning of Julian Jayne's book on the origin of consciousness where he speaks of this. And I can't remember the paragraph at the moment, but it's this kind of trying to capture the elusiveness of it, like, you know, the similes that the Buddha gave, like a mirage, like smoke, like an image in a mirror. All of these things are so true, aren't they? We close our eyes, we look into our mind, this is what things are like. It's like this kind of puppet show, there's like this kind of, what actually is there? Try to pin it down. And we have all these words and concepts and ideas about what there is in our mind, but when we try to actually focus on the reality of it, this is one of the reasons I always found it very difficult when I first read many years ago some psychology and reading some of the basic theories of Freud and things like that. I was always kind of wondering, well, what is this id that he keeps going on about? What is this ego? Like, where are they? And trying to find these things. Where are they? Trying to hunt them down. They're like echidnas. They're hiding out in the forest. And if you see them, they try to pretend that they're not really what they are. This is the realm that confounds our expectations. We would, you know, normally in the world we think that the closer we get to home, the more familiar we are, the more normal things get, the more controlled they are. You know, we're most at home, most comfortable in usually our own bedroom. And then outside of that bedroom, then there's the rest of the house. And then outside of the house is the neighborhood. and then outside of the neighborhood, maybe the city or the region, and then the country, where we still feel, you know, reasonably at home, and then we go to other countries and we feel much less at home. So the closer we come to home, the more comfortable we feel, the more intimate we are, the more we know what's there, and we're relaxed with that. But then when we take that step further and return into our minds, we don't find this kind of comfortable familiarity that we might expect. Instead, we find this very strange realm where we go deeper and we find platypuses and echidnas and wombats, things that hide down deep in tunnels and that you only see occasionally when they come out, and you can't really pin them down. Seems like the more you want to approach them, the more they try to veer away and hide themselves, pretend that they're not there. And so sometimes actually hunting for them is the wrong thing to do. And this is a very beautiful simile that Ajahn Chah gave, where he talked about if you want to see what animals there are that live in the forest, you know, there's no point in blundering around the whole forest looking for them, walking around trying to find them all the time, because they just hear you coming and then disappear. They melt into the jungle. They're always much more at home there than you are. And this, I'm afraid, is the way of psychology, or the way of kind of a more intellectualized approach to trying to understand the mind. That it's about kind of tramping around in big boots, collecting specimens. And so what Ajahn Chah said is, You don't do that. You realize, well, all the animals, what do they need? They need water. They need to drink. And it's their custom in the evening to come down to the pool and drink water. So you just go and sit by the pool and wait. You don't have to go running around for them. You just sit very quietly, find a secluded, concealed spot, sit comfortably, and be very patient. Just very at ease. Sitting there by the pool of water in the forest. And at the end of the hot day, then the animals will come down for a cool drink. They'll come and show themselves. You don't have to go hunting for them or looking for them. So our job in that role is to so to apprehend or to empathize with those animals, like to be with them. It's not our job. We're not like a biologist who has to kind of you know, map their usage and count the numbers of them and analyze their behaviors and so on and so forth. That's somebody else's job. Our job is just to feel them out, to try to gain the kind of gain some kind of intuition or like an intuitive communion with the animals, so that we feel what it's like from their point of view. So when we find the echidnas and the platypuses lurking in our own mind, then the job of a meditator is different from the job of a therapist. The job of a therapist is to sit there and tell the story of those things, to associate with them, to discuss them, bring them out and talk about them and so on. And that's one way of dealing with or responding it. But that's not the way that we use when we're in meditation. It's not the primary way. What we mainly do, the emphasis when we meditate is not to do any of those things. To resist doing those kinds of things. But our job as a meditator is just to feel what it's like from their point of view. To own them. So what's it like to be an echidna? What's it like to be a platypus? What's it like to be the creature from the Black Lagoon? What's it like? One of the things that Robert Thurman said in his talk today was that human beings or people are compassion. I think that was a very profound thing to say. I never looked at it in that light before, but I think there's some very deep truth in that. When we ask this question, what is it like? And this is that question that we're asking, what is it like? We're reaching out with that compassion which is able to reflect and understand those things which we think of as external to ourselves. We externalize them. Just as there's this kind of inner and outer in our world, like normally our inner is what we see inside this bag of skin. The outer is the world out there. But within the mind, there's also a similar inner and outer. So there's another dimension of inside and outside. And just as in this normal inner and outer sense, you know, we think what we tend to do is we tend to externalize and project our problems so that we think it's, you know, it's their fault, you know, it's her fault, it's his fault, it's John Howard's fault, it's whatever, whoever's fault, we blame. We put the blame outside. And very often we do that because we don't understand ourselves. And the more we look into ourselves, the more we understand ourselves, the more we're forgiving and understanding of different people. And we become much more, we can still criticize and praise and blame still works in the external world, but we do it in a more nuanced way, a more thoughtful way, a more reflective way, not in such a black and white way. All these ones are black and all those ones are white. We don't think like that anymore. same thing in in the inside of the inside. We have the mind and the other stuff we call like the objects of the mind in the vocabulary of the early suttas. This would be described as vijnana. It's like the awareness, and nama rupa is the external aspect of mind. It actually uses that phrase, vahidha nama rupa, the external nama rupa, in that sense, not meaning outside the body, the nama rupas of other people. It means inside the mind. But we see it as being external to the consciousness, the observing consciousness. And so in the same way we tend to externalize our problems, we blame our nama rupa for all of the different problems. We're kind of externalizing things. And it's not that that's wrong, but that it's one-sided, it's shallow, it's lacking in nuance. What's wrong is not the things themselves. So, you know, you can have like a bad thought, and we tend to demonize that thought. We think, oh, that thought's bad, and we want to cut it off and get rid of it, amputate it. But that thought isn't an isolated thing. It's part of a whole, this whole realm of showings and signs and symbols and inferences and images. These shimmering misty clouds in the mind. And these things are interconnected and interdependent on many, many, many levels in ways that we can't see. And this is an insight which I'm not sure how conscious the Buddhist traditions have been of this, but you can't actually see causes. The idea of a cause is this kind of metaphysical idea which happens only in abstraction. Perhaps Nagarjuna launched a critique of this thing. In Western philosophy, David Hume was the one who launched a critique of the notion of cause. What you can actually see is patterns of events, of happenings. And when I first read this critique by David Hume a number of years ago, and I had these kind of cold shivers down my spine, because I recognized that he had this very powerful argument that the notion of cause was essentially like, it was almost like a metaphysical thing. It's almost like the idea of cause is almost like a remnant of God. It's like a logical abstraction of the notion of God. God is the one who created the universe, so he's the prime mover, as Thomas Aquinas called him. Yet when we're talking about cause in general, we've like abstracted that notion, depersonalized it, but there's still this kind of abstract metaphysical thing which we can never see. You can never see cause. And I was shocked to read this argument and I thought, oh my God, we're completely deluded. I mean, how can Buddhists be so deluded that we think we're just studying dependent origination and understanding the nature of causality? And actually, it's just this kind of metaphysical imagination. And then I realized that when the Buddha spoke of cause, that's exactly what he was pointing to. He was pointing to patterns of phenomena, patterns of showings in the mind, and not the mind and outside the mind, but primarily in the mind. And he didn't point to the actual thing, the underlying metaphysical linkage which we assume happens between these things. So you have this imasming sati idang hoti, this being that is. Imasupada idang upajati, due to the arising of this that arises. Imasming asati idang nahoti, this not being that isn't. Imasanirodha idang nirujati, with the ending of this that ends. And so what you're seeing there with understanding causality and dependent origination is you're understanding these patterns of happenings that we can actually see. We can see the seed going in the soil, and we can see the shoot sprouting up from there, and we can see the plant growing from the shoot. We can't see the seed causing the sprout. We can't see the sprout causing the plant. That's just an assumption, or perhaps better, that's just a way of what we'd call a paññatti in Buddhism. It's like a way of talking about it. We talk about it using the notion of cause, but what we actually see is the phenomena. So when we look into our mind, we have a bad thought. What's the cause? We can't see the cause, actually, but what we can see is patterns of phenomena. We can see moods. We can see our contact with other people and situations. Ear contact, sounds, what people say, sight. Sometimes just seeing somebody can put you in a good mood or in a bad mood. And we see the patterns of these things. And we try, through the mist, through the elusiveness, through the ineffable showings, we try to make some sense of what's going on. And of course, this lack of understanding, this lack of clarity that we have, this of course is moha. This is exactly what moha is. That we're looking into our mind, we don't know what's going on. Why do we think like that? Why do we keep causing ourselves pain? Why are we overwhelmed with dukkha? Why are we swamped with dukkha? Why are we drowning in dukkha? We don't know, we can't see. Because these things are hidden from us. They're hiding in the forest. They're creeping down in their burrows. We can't see the connections, we can't see the links. But then somehow there is this feeling, maybe there's an escape, maybe there is a way of understanding, maybe there is something else. We've all felt that. Everybody here has that intuition. It's part of what it means to be human, I think. Maybe we experience it more clearly or less clearly, maybe more concrete form or more you know, less realized or reflected. But I think there's something in that. Sometimes maybe gazing up into the stars at night and just looking with a sense of wonder. Maybe down at the ocean, looking and just seeing the glistening surface of the water is always moving and shifting and then disappearing off over the horizon. Maybe it comes from just looking into a creek, a flow of water, and looking at the little creatures wriggling and playing in there and wondering what their life is like. Somehow there comes this sense of wonder and hope. And through all of the struggles and the disasters and the difficulties, this hope for liberation, hope for freedom is something that can sustain us. And something which is not, it's not, like, why is it there? Like, if it is universal, why is there that longing for freedom? Why is it there? Rousseau, the French philosopher, said man is born free but is everywhere in chains. But from a Buddhist point of view, it's exactly the opposite way around. We're all born in chains. We're born chained to our desires and our defilements. And the mystery of it is, why do we have the longing to be free? Why do we have this longing to be free? This is my talk for you this evening. I offer this for your contemplation. If anyone has any comments or questions?
Does it matter why we have the longing to be free? Isn't it just important that we know that we have it?
Does it matter why? I think it matters, yes.
And another thing, I think that was the most powerful simile I have ever heard. And I want Dhamma to wrap itself around me, and I want myself to be wrapped around the Dhamma tight as tight can be. I thought that was the most powerful thing you've ever said.
No, don't blame me. It's Tom Waits is the one who's responsible. He gets all the credit.
If it wraps around you, whether you like it or not.
Yeah.
The mind. mind and the heart is like this too. The mind is square, but the heart is round. The mind understands things in lines and clear cut, but the heart is
Yeah, which in a way is quite nice, you know. It's like you have these mandalas and things like that, where you have like the square and the circle, and put them inside each other, and actually, if they actually complement each other, so it's not a bad thing. That's a very good question. The water hole, well, this is like a simile that Ajahn Chacha used. He said, if you want to stroke the cat, then if you go chasing it and trying to grab it by the ears or by the whiskers and pulling at you, then it's going to yowl and scratch you. But if you put down a nice glass of milk, then the cat will come up and then start lapping it, and you can just stroke it and so on all you like. So the clear water, or the sweet milk, is a simile, or the meaning of that is that the happiness, the peace of samadhi. And when there's the peace in the mind, then it's just this kind of the cool of the evening in the mind, and it's just this natural sense of peacefulness and stillness about those things. And one of the nice things about that simile of Ajahn Chah is that, you know, again, we don't quite... we're a bit insulated from those things, because we do in our life, we've lived in the city, or perhaps we've lived in Australian bush where we do have echidnas and wombats and so on. And of course Ajahn Chah, talking from his own experience, was talking of his experience of living in jungles with elephants and tigers and things like that. And so, but they too would be coming out of the forest, and bears, and so it'd be quite, you know, there's no, it's the kind of thing, if you blunder across this while you're walking around the forest, it'd be quite dangerous. But if you know that they've come just to drink in the evening, they're not hunting, they're not looking for food, they're just coming to have a drink of water, and you can actually just sit there and watch it. So this is why in samadhi, in the peace of the mind, then you can allow the monsters to arise, and it's okay, you know? They're not going to gobble you up.
Can you call them up?
Can you gobble them up? No, because that shows that you don't like them. They're okay. It's like anything, the monsters in the mind are, they're not intrinsically monstrous or intrinsically good or intrinsically bad, you know? They become like that because of the way that they're treated, just like an animal, you know? Like you can have a vicious tiger or something like that. If you treat it badly, then it will get very angry and it's very dangerous. But if you leave it about its business and treat it with respect, then it's not such a problem. Well, I kind of deliberately left it unanswered. Yeah. maybe I'll leave it for now, and you can all have a think about it, see what you reckon. Maybe you can talk about it in a while. But I've got a feeling maybe for what the answer would be, but I think it's interesting to I think it's a very interesting question to raise, very fundamental question.
What was the question? I can't hear it.
Question was, Eva, why do we have the longing to be free?
Oh.
What's the answer?
It's a time waster. Know that you want to be free and work on that. Why do you have to know why? Why eat of the tree of knowledge like that?
Because that's what the Buddha did. He ate of the fruit of the tree of knowledge.
And he told us everything that we needed to know.
No, he didn't. Okay.